excision number 12267, reel 2.
Tony Gibson, reel 2.
Gibson, reel 2.
Right. The question of how much we were aware of Nazi and, for that matter, fascist repression on racial grounds. My recollection is that that was there, but it wasn't as important as the general repression of free thought. And that went right across the board. We didn't know about the 6 million exterminations. And in fact, I remember going down to the village of Nordhausen from Ilfeld, the school where we were. I used to sneak down to get kuchen because there was very little sugar in the diet. So we'd sneak down to get sweet cakes. And I remember going to the post office and beginning a conversation with someone. It was then abruptly cut short because someone else came in. And I was totally unaware that Nordhausen was actually the feeder for a concentration camp. And one of the other members of the party came back in 1945 as an officer in Allied military government to that place and wrote in the school magazine about the fact that that was what had been happening, but we had all been unaware of it. So, coming back to the question of the... I've lost my thread at this point.
It really was your knowledge of the nature of Hitler's regime.
Yes. Well, I mean, I was quite sure that it was an abominable regime, and so was Mussolini's. I was quite certain that it had to be opposed. That's why, in the year of the phony war, when I thought that it was very probable that we would be invaded, I tried to get together, you know, sort of correspond with people to try and get something called cords, coordinating, to get the nucleus of some kind of resistance. And as I say, I mean, I was totally, starry-eyed. I had no idea what it really entailed. But it was, in my mind, that resistance was the primary concern. You had got to resist these people. The question is, what's the most effective way in which to resist them? And I'd come to the conclusion that you couldn't deal effectively by behaving as they did. And this is something that's been dominant in my feelings ever since, that you have to judge what you are doing by whether it corresponds with what you're after. You can't get away with black propaganda dirty tricks and gas Boer War concentration camps. You can't get away with any of this without in turn generating more of it, but not merely on the other side, but on your own side, that people become accustomed to those notions as being viable, that you can, you can cope with a fire by spraying petrol. So, right the way through, I felt that I had to find practical ways to express what I was on about, even if they seemed a bit tinkering, because I was convinced And I am convinced that in the long run, the commitment to the methods developed by the Nazis and the fascists and Saddam Hussein and all the rest, doing that to them infects us. It doesn't match. So I wanted all the time to find a practical expression that said, right, this is all happening outside my range. I'm aware that these things are happening. I have to do something that makes sense in itself, not simply the assumption that something small is all you should ever do, because I believe that something small has to add up to something big, as perhaps has been the case over the last few days. Because if you take the sea change, the groundswell that has occurred in the Eastern Bloc first and now in the Soviet Bloc, that's an indication of people being dissatisfied with the way of doing things that was imposed on them, and resisting that to a large extent by just going and being there and taking a risk. There were four chaps who were killed outside the White House in Moscow, and there were shots fired. Perhaps those shots contributed to the killings. Perhaps the thing could have escalated and it could have ended in a bloodbath. But the fact that people went and presented themselves because that was something they could see made sense, that's what I think counts. And it does add up. So when the raids started in September 1940, I mean, of course, there'd been raids before. In the summer, I shot off, I hitchhiked all the way from London to Haverford West in Pembrokeshire in order to propose to my future wife. She turned me down because I thought I wanted to just get that clear out of the way. But okay. Then I came back because I thought, right, now we're in for it and we're probably going to be invaded and it's going to be fairly bloody. Well, then the raid started, and the chap who with me was earning a pittance by being caretakers for the ILP building in Clapham. There was a four-storey building which had four meeting rooms for trade unions, and we were allowed to have the top storey in return for keeping the place clean. And so we were living as students and expecting to go back on the next year, because I had by then been up before a tribunal and had been registered conditional on my continuing and completing my studies. And so we were a bit short of money, and we heard about a chap, friend of ours, who was up in York earning 50 shillings a week in a logging camp. And so we hitchhiked up, and as we hitchhiked up, took about 7 hours. One of the chaps who picked us up says, "There's a bit more trouble down there." Didn't say any more than that. So we then got up, and we had to get up at about 5:30 in the morning, go out on a bus to this log camp, cut logs until we were absolutely exhausted, come back, eat, and fall. And it was only by about Thursday that we realised that the raids had started. So we hitchhiked, we waited to get our money on Friday morning and hitchhiked straight down to Clapham and stayed overnight in Clapham, sitting on the roof in order to watch the raids. And there were sort of Molotov, you know, there were Molotov bread baskets of incendiaries dropping around, and we had a ringside seat. So then that was just the Friday night. Then we set off on Saturday morning because someone I knew, who was then the president of the National Union of Students, Mary Corsellis, had got word to us that there was something doing down in Poplar. So we shot off to Poplar, and there were various students who were helping there, and they said, we've got enough, but in Stepney there's plenty. So we went to Stepney, where a number of rather highfalutin, very nice, very good establishment people had been running three youth clubs. There was Vera Grenfell, who was, I think, in the Curzon family, and they were in cahoots with Lord Halifax, who visited us at one point, and with Conservative MPs and so on. But I turned up and said, what can I do? And they said, oh, well, come and help. And it was just a question of dishing out tea. And then the obvious thing seemed to be the sewage, because people were living in shelters which were just railway arches blocked up at either side, and there's no sanitation at all, or they were living
the tubes.
Well, the tubes, that wasn't so bad. Mm-hmm. But they were living in underneath warehouses, and they were living underneath churches. What's the word for...
Oh, the basements.
Not sepulchre, the...
The crypts.
Crypts, church crypts. And by I had, in fact, very early on, before I even registered as a conshi, I had signed up with a pacifist ambulance unit. And I was quizzed at my tribunal, how many ambulances had it got? And I said, none yet. And then I heard about the pacifist service unit, so I signed on with that. Nothing happened. So when I got to Stepney and to this place, Paddy's Goose, which is a pub which was named Paddy's Goose because a drunk Irishman had looked at the swan and said, that's a goose. And the swan was up a bar relief over the thing. So I got on to these chaps and said, what the hell are you doing? Why aren't you sending people? And where is the pacifist service unit? They said, you're it. We will send people. So over the next few months, we got eventually three sections of 10, which we dispersed in and around Shadwell. And the main thing we had a go at was going round to all these shelters and taking the buckets of shit and going to a manhole and tipping them down and scattering bug powder everywhere. That was in the morning. In the afternoon, we went to houses that had been bombed out and rescued people's belongings, particularly pianos. the number of pianos that we actually got, which people regarded as very important, you know. But, and I remember a marvellous time on New Year's night when we were all out in the street doing Knees Up Mother Brown to somebody's piano in the early hours. And that was, again, a very sort of happy, you know, it was... Oh, thanks be to God that has matched us with this hour. And we, in the evening, we would go round to all these shelters with a medical satchel to dish out things, and we also had medical satchels. Eventually, I evolved a sort of white knight equipage. I mean, it really was just like the white knight. It was a bicycle on which we strapped a stirrup pump, canvas buckets, medical supplies, and we had one flat in a basement which was bombed out. And then we went up and we got hold of a flat on the top floor, because the top floor flats were not very popular, but it gave us a great vantage point. So we went to the top flat in Ring House, which was just off the highway, the Ratcliffe Highway as it used to be. And we would spot, we'd have chaps spotting, you see, and if we saw anything, out we go, dash off. I don't think we did much use in terms of rescue or firefighting, but we were regarded as good people. The fire brigade gave us training in using hoses and things, at the time of Dunkirk, soldiers came back and started talking about these bloody conscies, what are they doing? People said, don't you talk about them. About time you did something useful. So there wasn't any feeling of anti-country that I knew of. So I had an easy time in that respect, and a rewarding time, because we felt ourselves to be needed. It was exciting. I can remember coming out in the early hours of the morning and trying to decide whether it was sunrise or fires that was brightening the sky. And it was after the all clear, and I felt, God, great, we survived this. So there was, you know, it was a great feeling, because what we were doing, although it was a tinkering, in fact, it probably helped to avert the spread of epidemics. I picked up diphtheria and had to retire to the South Eastern Fever Hospital in New Cross for a few weeks, where it was also bombed. And then came back again in time for Christmas and the really great fire of London. So that went on. And I had a good relationship with two local bodies. One was the Church of England, the Red Anglicans. There was a chap called Father John Grosser, Grosser. And he was one of the people who had got things going. And I remember that quite early on in the Blitz, there were various reporters who came down. Richie Calder came down and described Father Grosser stroking his white beard, which he didn't have. It was a great sort of... it was a great media thing, these people who were suddenly coping with things. So all the stuff about the unconquerable feelings of local people, which every now and then gets a rather snide reference nowadays, there's one just recently, I think, I would say it's genuine, it really happened. People did come out of their shells, and in any case they had a long tradition of mutual help. And although in shelters there were knife fights sometimes and there were racial clashes, they were held back by shelter committees that formed spontaneously, largely by working class people. Grosser and his colleagues, including a diocesan church worker called Ethel Upham, who I got on very well with, were in the forefront of all this, and they had been in the forefront. He was the chap who led in 1937 or 8 the Stepney Tenants' rent strike, so he was, I thought, this is the sort of guy. He'd had a war record, I think, as an officer, rather like George MacLeod of Iona, but he'd come round to what I think was probably a degree of pacifism. Another guy was the Reverend Alex Miller. Alex Miller was a Presbyterian minister at St. Paul's Church, and St. Paul's Crypt was one of the places that we used to go and do things in. And he had been organising the National Income Average groups. He was trying to get national average income as a practical demonstration of what socialism should mean. So he produced pamphlets about how you calculated the national average, and then a sort of budget system whereby you added a bit or subtracted a bit according to what you were doing. And he had also got connections with the Iona community. And I met George MacLeod, the founder of the Iona community, in his flat. And George was very brusque, and I didn't think very much of him. So Lex Miller later became the deputy leader of the Iona community, and George MacLeod said of him, I've seen the biography which I've just been reading, that he was a Barthian on Sundays and a Marxist on weekdays, and he was constantly sort of hammering theologically at George, but I think it was very good for him. But in fact, to me, he was a very gentle sort of person and very practical. And the third person that I had dealings with, a bloke called Douglas Millard, who was a Quaker, who had a little tiny Quaker cause, and He had two workers with him, and their main contribution, as far as we were concerned, that they made the most marvellous apple dumpling sinkers. And I remember going along when we only had one tin hat between four of us, running along the high street en route for a meal with them, and none of us putting on the tin hat because we didn't feel that anyone should have it, meanwhile hearing all the shrapnel tinkling on the pavements. There were these people, and there were also local people who had this strong local feeling. And we began to work in a youth club there and a few things like that. Then, as after May 1941, I suppose it must have been, the raids lessened. And then we began to feel a little bit sort of at a loss. OK, we got the youth club thing. We were doing a certain amount of casework. And there was a chap called Arthur Collis who had joined us, who subsequently wrote a good book on casework. And he was really a contributor to converting what we had set up into the Stepney Family Service Units, which still survives. And the Family Service Unit was the notion of working on the spot, living in, and helping people who were on the margins in whatever way was appropriate. And that's continued, although they've been up against financial problems recently. But it's continued ever since. And there was another pacifist service unit in Liverpool, which turned into another family service unit. But by that time, getting on for 1942, I was feeling a bit at a loss, because I think I wanted excitement, and I wanted something that was sort of could demonstrate, and I wasn't sure that just sort of helping in this way was my thing. And I actually seriously, I'm not sure how serious it was. I remember sitting on a bus with Lex Miller saying, I wonder whether I ought to volunteer for the RAF. Because I was sort of feeling at a loss. And it was partly also because the momentum was slackening. And you generate a lot of adrenaline. And that there comes a time when you're simply going on, and you begin to wonder. But I decided against that.
It seems quite a drastic move, you know, that you thought of going into the forces.
That's right.
Yes. Did you reconsider your pacifism at that stage?
I was wondering, but I mean, I've always wondered. I mean, at university, with my contemporaries at university, there were some who were teetering in the direction of conscientious objection. There were some who were teetering in the direction of joining up. And we compared notes. We both found ourselves on a knife edge. And that was quite clear in 1939. So, I decided that I was going to try and get abroad a bit nearer the action. Although I'd rather look down my nose at the Friends Ambulance Unit in the past, the Friends Ambulance Unit had a base at the London Hospital Students' Hostel, which was locally known as the Conchi Ritz. And there were all the students there, and we in the Pacifist Service Unit regarded them with a certain amount of, you know, all very well, but they're not really sort of down to anything basic, you know. They're doing, you know, we were a bit sort of toffee-nosed about it, really, or a bit highfalutin. We thought we were the ones who were actually where the action was, and these other chaps were sort of organised in a large way. However, when it went quiet in that way, I put in for the FAU, and they accepted me, and I wanted to go to China. I had met some of the FAU people on the first group that went out to China, because they were staying in the Highgate Youth Hostel, and I used to go to the hostel on my weekend breaks when I had them. And so I met them then, and So I wanted to go to China. But of course, you know, the principal of the FAU was go anywhere, do anything, so you had to accept that. And so I went, first of all, to St. James's Hospital, and I was made a section leader there. And then I was made a section leader in an emergency hospital in Winford near Bristol. And I forget whether there was any other, but by and by, I was picked to go on a course that was originally intended to be in Phoenix Park in Ireland. So it was always called Phoenix Park. In fact, it ended up in Hampstead, in a big double house there. And the idea was that was sort of international chaps who were going to be going in for relief and rehabilitation.
You didn't go to one of the basic training camps?
Oh, yes, I did, yes.
Did you? Yes,
I went to Camp 15. Yes, that's right.
How did you find it after the pacifist service unit, you know, going into the FAU?
It wasn't too bad at all. I was always a bit suspicious of what I thought of as the sort of chocolate hegemony. And I continued and have continued to be a bit dubious about the way in which the people who were funding the thing remained in control. And they always have. And although they're nice chaps individually, I thought this was really not quite on. And so, you know, okay. But at the camp, there was Michael Cadbury, who was the commandant, and I liked him. And he was, again, sort of very mellifluous chap, you know. And I thought it was well run, and my section, again, I had, was a section leader, and I drilled these chaps, you know. We used to go out and practice, you see. We were determined to be elite, you see. So there was this sort of element. At the same time, I also used to disappear when we had off moments with some of the more dissident guys to go and have a cup of tea and buns at a local cafe. So it was a mixture. It was sort of conforming to the whole thing in order to make it work, but also not entirely swallowing it whole. So then went on to St. James's, and my great ambition was to scrub up in the operating theatre, and I achieved that, including a great party on Christmas night, because the chap who was the... Am I going on too reminiscent? The chap who was the principal surgeon was an expert on disemboweling people, and one of the chaps he disemboweled was a publican who, in gratitude, sent an enormous case of spirits for Christmas. So we decorated the operating theatre with gentian violet strips and acroflavin strips. In sort of loops all around the theatre. We cooked a Christmas pudding in the steriliser, and we had a great party. I remember at one point sort of rushing down a passage with a nurse on a trolley. I can't remember what happened to that. And then coming into the operating theatre, which was deserted, except for the operating theatre's sister, the very attractive redhead, who was flat out on the floor, totally drunk. So... There was also a very intimidating ward sister, whom I greatly respected, who had a very exacting requirement, and she cottoned on to the idea that some of us really wanted to go somewhere, and she would occasionally sort of talk about China or something like that. And she wouldn't have anything that was not perfect, you see, and I thought this was very good.
This doesn't sound very Quakerly, this sort of behaviour. You know, I was wondering if there was any difference between the Quakers and non-Quakers in the unit.
Well, it wasn't... I mean, we would have a section meeting, which we would try to organise in a way that had a little bit of silence in it. But I think all the time, in most of the context that I was in, I tended to be someone who... take a top dressing of Quakerism, but was dissatisfied with where it seemed to me sometimes to be too cautious or too, now what's the word? Too stubborn in confronting alternatives. That there was an innate feeling that fundamentally we're not going to change.